In Romans chapter 1, Paul begins his argument. Perhaps argument isn't a very positive sounding word. Paul's not necessarily being argumentative, but he is presenting an argument, a case, for a viewpoint which he anticipates some people not agreeing with and maybe picking at. You know, when he makes a point, he realizes some people who don't agree might be looking for every fault that they could imagine or that they see in his argument. And so he is very circumspect in his presentation of his gospel. And it is indeed an argument. It's not contentious. It's not argumentative. But he does present the argument for the gospel. And the argument is directed, it would seem, primarily toward Jewish people. Which is not to say that Gentiles would not also find occasion to be corrected by things that Paul says, but there are many evidences in especially the first three or four chapters, if not all the way into chapter 8, that Paul has the Jewish objector in mind, primarily. Although some of the objections that will come up that he will deal with could come from, you know, a Gentile who misunderstands him as well. But I personally believe that he's got the Jewish objector in mind primarily, and he's directing his comments toward that Jewish objector. You will recall that I feel there is evidence in the book of Romans for some measure of hostility, or if not hostility, at least tension, between the Jewish and the Gentile elements in the church in Rome. And that tension, as might be predicted, would be over the issue of cultural or religious sensitivities about certain Jewish behaviors. In Romans 14, there's a discussion of people in the church who have different convictions about what they should eat from each other. And they have different convictions about the observance of holy days. And these particular convictions sound very much like the kinds of things that Jews and Gentiles would differ over. And that only serves to confirm what impressions we get earlier in the book, that there is a need to address the Jews about their judging the Gentiles in the church, which the Jews typically did, apparently, and also to address the Gentiles that they not disrespect the Jews and their sensitivities in the church. So Paul is making an appeal for unity in the church, and a unity particularly between those with Jewish convictions and those who don't have Jewish convictions in the church. And the division of these two categories would probably be largely a racial division between those who are Jewish by birth and by upbringing and had become Christians on the one hand, and those who had no such Jewish upbringing or convictions and had become Christians and found themselves thrust into the same fellowship with these other people. Now, Paul, of course, was a Jew, and perhaps as such he felt more comfortable rebuking the Jews for their Jewish ideas. If he were a Gentile rebuking the Jews, he might be thought to be entering into the spirit of racial, you know, superiority. You know, I mean, a Gentile criticizing the Jews. If I were to stand in judgment of the wrongs done by representatives of the black races in recent history, let's say, the fact that I'm a white man might make people think, oh, he's just another racist. But if I were a black man critiquing some of the abuses of my own race, then no one can really charge me with entering into a spirit of racism. If I, as a person within the charismatic movement, critique things within the charismatic movement, there should no one cry foul about that. But if I was an anti-charismatic and spent my time criticizing charismatics, one might think that I had a sectarian or denominational axe to grind. Now, Paul was a Jew, and a Jew who had been in his early life known for his zeal for the law, and he understood very well that Jews have this zeal, and that Jews, it's not the easiest thing, once you are converted, to give up all of your sensitivities. I'm sure that many of you have sensitivities, whether they are moral sensitivities or other kinds, tastes in food and clothing and things like that, which, when you became a Christian, those tastes didn't all immediately change, and maybe they never will. sensitivities are developed in early in life, and the Jewish people, obviously, if they grew up thinking it's wrong to eat certain foods, even though they become Christians and they're told it's no longer wrong to eat it, still the foods, you know, they've been grown up with an abhorrence with that. And they probably, in more cases than not, would maintain a kosher diet. But the problem is when they begin to be offended by the Gentile Christians who don't maintain a kosher diet. Now, the Jews, as a people, in the first century, tended to be very much have an attitude of superiority. This, in fact, is ironic in view of the fact that their own history shows that they were a rebellious and stubborn people. Their own prophets called them that. That their history was made up more of rebellion against God than obedience to God. They did not show themselves to be a superior race in terms of holiness. In fact, their prophets said that the Jews had defiled themselves more than the people of the land that God had driven out before them. And yet, perhaps because the Jews had been persecuted so much throughout their history, they had, as maybe a defensive mechanism, developed the idea that they're being persecuted because they are God's people. Now, the Jehovah's Witnesses have sort of this attitude. The more you treat them badly, and by the way, you shouldn't, but they do get a bit of bad treatment. You may notice the Kingdom Halls don't have windows. It's not because they don't want anyone looking. It's because vandals break their windows. Jehovah's Witnesses are more despised than most religious groups in our Western culture. People object to them more. But the more they are objected to, the more they are convinced that proves they are God's people. Because, after all, God's people are to be hated by those who are the devil's people. And there's a certain mentality that grows in a group that is persecuted for its convictions or for its distinctives. To either say, wow, maybe I ought to reconsider my convictions because everybody says I'm wrong, or else to go the opposite direction and say, well, this is happening to us because we are God's people, because we are different. And these people just can't stand our righteous superiority that God, you know, has given to us, to them. And this seems to be the direction that many of the Jews, perhaps most of the Jews, went in their reaction to the persecutions they'd been in. Even though there were very little evidences that Jews were better people, or even more obedient to God's laws, taken on the whole, than the Gentiles, yet they just had this ingrained assumption. I am Jewish. I am part of the chosen people. This race to which I belong, in which I've been born, has been privileged among all people. God has dwelt among these people. He's given us the tabernacle and the temple, and this is where God dwells. The Gentiles have never been visited by God in this way. God has given us His laws. God has never given laws to the Gentiles, and therefore the laws that we have are pure and good laws. The Gentile laws are unworthy of honor or respect at all, no matter how wise the men were who formulated them. They are of human origin, not of divine origin. And the Jews believed that simply because they were born in the Jewish race and because they had the law, which was the greatest privilege they had received from God, besides the formation of their nation in the time of Moses, that they were ipso facto a superior people in the sight of God. And this was this is the attitude that resided in their thinking about themselves vis-a-vis the Gentiles. And so it was fairly natural for the Jews to look upon the Gentiles, even the Jews in the church, to look upon the Gentiles in the church as a lesser breed without the law, as an inferior people, as a people who perhaps they could be saved, but if they could be saved, they should really become as much like Jews as possible, get circumcised and follow the Jewish law, or if not that, maybe they could even be saved without that, but only would they be recognized as a lesser Christian, because they were not of the chosen people. I mean, maybe God in His mercy could allow some of these dogs into the household, but they will always be dogs as opposed to children. This is apparently the attitude Paul is addressing. It was not unusual among the Jews of the early centuries of Christianity. And we can see that everything Paul says, especially in the first four chapters of Romans, is calculated to address that attitude. Now, that is, you might say, that's not so obvious to me as I read chapter 1. Most people believe that chapter 1 is a brief against the Gentiles, that Paul is writing a condemnation of the Gentiles and their lifestyle. In fact, the way that most scholars, in fact, maybe all scholars I've ever heard of, understand the first three chapters is this. This is the outline they'll give of the first three chapters. Now, write it in pencil. But in any commentary I've ever seen, or any teacher of Romans I've ever heard, including myself in earlier years, this is the outline of chapters 1 through 3, I believe, was there. Chapter 1, Paul devotes to showing how sinful the Gentiles are. Chapter 2 turns on the Jews and shows how sinful they are. And chapter 3 more or less summarizes that the Jews and the Gentiles are both sinful. So that what has been accomplished in the first three chapters is that Paul has devoted special attention to the Gentiles and special attention to the Jews, and then summarized that both the Jews and the Gentiles are clearly equally evil and both need salvation. You see, Paul is here to sell the gospel. I mean, not for money, of course, but like a salesman, he has to, if he has a product he hopes people will embrace. And by the way, it does cost something, a great deal. People don't just embrace the gospel lightly if they understand what it's demanding of them. You have to convince the people, first of all, that this is a needed commodity. If somebody comes to my door trying to sell some kind of a widget that I don't even have any idea how I would use or what I'd made it for, I'm not going to have any interest in laying out the money for it. But if somehow they can show me that I have a problem and that this widget is just the thing that will solve my problem, and that the solution to the problem tremendously outweighs in value the expense that will be laid out in putting it out, then I'll give it consideration. Might even buy it. And every salesperson knows that. You have to first let the people know that they need what you have to offer. And Paul's offer, of course, is the offer of salvation through Christ. Now, you might think, well, everyone would know they need that. But some people don't. Some people don't think they need God. They don't think they need what they would call religion. They don't need Jesus. They don't need even give a thought to their spiritual lives. And the more comfortable they are, the more prosperous they are at the moment, the more the tendency is to feel they don't need God. Remember, even the church of Laodicea, according to the book of Revelation, said, we are rich and we have need of nothing. And they didn't know that they're blind and miserable and naked and so forth. Now, Paul wanted to let the people know, of course, that they were blind and miserable and naked, and that they needed eye salve, and they needed clothing, and they needed a touch from God. They needed forgiveness of sins. But people will not sense the need for forgiveness of sins until they sense that they are sinners, and that this is a problem to them. And so, as Paul begins to lay out the gospel, he devotes the early part of his argument to make it a very convincing case that people need salvation. They are sinners. They are corrupt. They are worthy of death. Once a person realizes he's sick, he may be interested in taking the bitter medicine. But if he doesn't think he's sick, that medicine is unpleasant enough that he doesn't want to endure the sacrifice of taking it. And so we do in fact have in the first three chapters Paul's way of laying out the need for salvation. He presents the gospel need, first of all, in terms of the universal sinfulness of man. But I would now not agree fully with those who have laid out these three chapters in this division I mentioned earlier, namely that chapter 1 is about the Gentiles, chapter 2 is about the Jews, and that chapter 3 draws it all together and says the Jews and the Gentiles are all under sin. Now, it might look at first like that's the correct interpretation of these chapters, because if you look at chapter 3, verse 9, Paul says, what then, are we better than they? Meaning, are we Jews better than those Gentiles? And the answer is no, not at all. For we have previously charged both Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. Some would see this as the summary of the chapters 1 and 2 and the verses before this in chapter 3. We have previously charged, meaning in the earlier chapters, the part we've just finished, we have demonstrated that the Jews and the Greeks are all under sin. Now, if that is Paul's interpretation of what he has done in the first 2.5 chapters, it seems to support the notion so commonly given by commentators that chapter 1 was about Greeks or Gentiles, chapter 2 about Jews, and Paul in chapter 3 says, we have now demonstrated that both the Jews and the Greeks are under sin. And I do believe he demonstrates that in the first two chapters, but I do not agree with the assumption about chapter 1 and 2. I will demonstrate from showing you many scriptures that I think Paul has another way he is demonstrating this. In other words, I do not believe that chapter 1 is about the Gentiles. That is a shocking thing to say to anyone who's done serious study of Romans, because everybody believes chapter 1 is about the Gentiles. I do not. And I'll show you why. He begins his discussion after his basic introduction. His introduction we covered last time was in the first 15 verses. So he picks up at verse 16 to begin his argument proper. He says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, for the Jew first, and also for the Greek. For in it," that is in the gospel, "the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness in the lusts of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason God gave them up to vile passions, for even their women exchanged the natural use for what is against nature. Likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust for one another, men with men, committing what is shameful, and receiving in themselves the penalty of the error which was due. And even if they did not, as they did not, like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who, knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them." And then in order to fully understand what Paul is getting at, we need to read the first verse of the next chapter. "Therefore you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are who judge. For in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourself. For you who judge practice the same things." Now, I read the entire passage because an exposition of each verse requires that we have in mind the whole block of discussion here. Paul begins by saying in verse 16, "I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ." This is actually starts with the word "for," because, which means he's continuing from what he said in the previous verse. He has said in the previous verses that he has evangelized among Greeks and barbarians and so forth. And he says in verse 15, "So as much as is in me, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome also, because I'm not ashamed of the gospel." Now, "I'm ready to preach the gospel in Rome also," even though, and he doesn't say this, but we know this about him, he has experienced great trials because of his preaching the gospel. He's been run out of town more times than he could count. He's been beaten with rods. He's been received 39 lashes on 5 occasions. He's been shipwrecked. He's had all these experiences because of the gospel. He has been treated like a fool in Athens. He has faced lions in Ephesus, or wild beasts, as he put it. All these things could discourage a person from continuing on the course that's causing him all of this grief. He could find the gospel to be shameful. I mean, it is a reproach to him. He says in 1 Corinthians, we apostles, we're like the offscouring of the world. We're made a spectacle to all men. And there is reason why a man of lesser conviction, a lesser respect for the gospel, would bail out, would back off, and say, this gospel, it's not really winning me any friends. It's not really contributing to my self-esteem or my prestige in society. I think I will pursue something that is a little more worthy of my talents, my training. I mean, with the kind of training and talents Paul had, he could have been a famous rabbi among his own Jewish people, highly respected, probably sit on the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court. That's a pretty high appointment. But he forsook all that. He was separated under the gospel, he said in chapter 1, verse 1. Like he had previously been separated to the law when he was a Pharisee. Now he was totally devoted to the gospel. And no matter how much reproach it brought on him, as opposed to other courses of life he could choose, he was not ashamed, because the thing he was suffering for, the thing that people mocked him for and persecuted him for, was something that he did not find to be embarrassing in the least. That which some would be ashamed of, he was not ashamed of, because he realized that what he was preaching, what he had devoted his life to, was nothing less than the power of God. I mean, if you had a powerful gun and you were carried back in a time machine, back to the time where people had bows and arrows, and you're walking the street packing this gun, and everyone with their bows and arrows were laughing at you because they thought you were unarmed. They didn't recognize this little thing you had. It's puny compared to the bows and arrows they have and the weapons they use. Their spears are as long as a man. Your gun's not even as long as your hand. And they mocked him for it and so forth. He wouldn't probably be ashamed of his gun, because he knows that that gun, whatever men may think of it, is far more powerful than those men have any clue about. And that if it really came to a confrontation, he's more than a match for any of them with whatever they had. It's like if no one knew about the atom bomb, and one country had the atom bomb and everybody else had conventional bombs. And they looked at the atom bomb and it just looked like they just said, you only have one bomb. You know, we've got 100 bombs in our Air Force. You only have one bomb. And they mocked you for having only one bomb because they didn't know the power of that thing. And it's like that when the philosophers and people of other religions mocked Paul for the gospel, he said, I'm not ashamed, because I know something they don't know. This message I have, unlike any of theirs, is the power of God. Now, that's a power second to none. They don't know what I'm packing here, but I do. And they can say anything they want about it, but they can't make me feel humiliated, because I know what I've got here under the hood. I've got the power of God. And I see it work. And even when I'm not seeing it work, I don't have any doubts about its potential, about what it can do. It is the power of God for salvation. That's why I'm not ashamed of it. It is a powerful message. It is a life-changing message. It's the only message that can do the things that God wants done in the human heart. And therefore, I'm coming to Rome with it. I may expect a bit of ridicule from some there. I might be rejected by some. I might be even persecuted. But I'm not ashamed. I'm ready to preach the gospel in Rome also, and I'm not ashamed of it. Because I have seen and I know what the power of God is in the gospel. It changes lives. It saves people. But not everyone. It only saves those who believe. It is the power of God to him, to everyone who believes. And then he says this phrase, for the Jew first and also for the Greek. Now this expression, for the Jew first and also for the Greek, is repeated other places in the book of Romans. For example, in chapter 2, you'll find it. Because he says in verse 9, there's tribulation, chapter 2, verse 9, tribulation, anguish on every soul of man who does evil, on the Jew first and also on the Greek. But verse 10, but glory, honor, and peace to everyone who works what is good, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Now this business about being to the Jew first and also to the Greek, I've known people to take this various ways. Some people feel that what Paul is saying is the Jew is indeed superior in the sight of God to the Greek or to the Gentile. God, as far as God's concerned, the Jew is first in priority. The Jew is first in importance. And I've heard Christian evangelists in my lifetime say, you know, we need to recognize that we have an obligation first to evangelize the Jewish people. And that some have even gone so weird as to say, yeah, we shouldn't even involve ourselves in Gentile evangelism until we've reached the Jews in our area. I mean, they're trying to shame us into Jewish evangelism because they point out that there's great negligence on the part of many Christians in the area of reaching out to the Jews. And there is. And most Jewish outreaches are actually conducted by Jewish Christians rather than Gentile Christians, though there are Gentiles who do get involved. But to use Paul's expression here, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, in such a way as to suggest that God gives a priority to the Jews that makes them somehow more important or have a first rank, is to miss Paul's point entirely. You'll notice, I just read to you chapter 2, verses 9 and 10, each of those verses end with the expression, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, and the very next line, verse 11, says, for there is no partiality with God. Now, if he is saying that the Jew is first in rank, or in importance, or in status, or in significance over the Greek, then he contradicts himself when he says, for there is no partiality with God, because he would certainly be saying there is. God is concerned about the Jew first. That's partiality. So when Paul says to the Jew first, and also secondarily to the Greek, the point he is making is not that there is partiality, but the opposite, there is not. And what he must be addressing then is not, he's not addressing the attitude, the wrong attitude, that, you know, Jews and Greeks are about equal. And he wants to correct that and say, no, the Jews first, and then the Greek. Let's keep that in the proper order here. The attitude he's addressing is that of the Jews who thought it's the Jews only. Salvation is for the Jews. Salvation is for Israel. And they identified Israel as the Jews. He says, no, hang on here. It was to the Jew first. That is, in terms of history, certainly the Jew had first opportunity, but will also have the more severe judgment because they had more opportunity. The punishment will be on the Jew first also, he says in Romans 2:9, as well as the rewards. Because not because they're higher in status, but because they had first opportunity. They had first dibs before the Gentiles ever heard anything about the God who made them. God had already revealed himself to the Jews. They had first opportunity. When Jesus came, he preached to his own people first. In fact, we don't ever read of Jesus ever addressing a Gentile audience. There were individual Gentiles that Jesus had conversations with, but we never find him going to Gentile lands and addressing an audience of Gentiles. His preaching was directed to the Jews. In fact, when a Gentile woman came and asked for help for her daughter who was demon-possessed, Jesus said, I've not been sent but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Indicating that he was not at that point at liberty to go out and evangelize Gentiles. He was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel first. In fact, when Paul went out and evangelized, even in Gentile lands, he first went to the synagogues where the Jews were to be found. Very often he found that the Jews there rejected his message and the Gentiles who were visiting accepted it. And usually a church would grow with very few Jews, although Paul made his appeal to the Jews first. In Pisidian Antioch, in Acts chapter 13, Paul preached there, and the Jews rejected his message, and he stamped the dust off his feet, and he said, it was necessary that the gospel first be preached to you, meaning the Jews. But since you reject it and count yourselves unworthy of eternal life, we now go to the Gentiles. It was necessary that the gospel first be preached to them. Jesus first preached to the Jews. Now, that didn't prevent Paul from preaching to Gentiles before there were Jews who had heard when there were still Jews who hadn't heard the message. Paul preached to everybody. But he made his first appeal in the synagogue of the Jews because they were and had always been the people that God had made promises to, and they had to have the first opportunity to respond to those promises. But in their rejection of those promises, or even if they had not rejected, even if they accepted them, eventually the Gentiles also had an opportunity to come in too. But it wasn't because the Jews were more important or were somehow innately superior. They just had the first chance. But they shouldn't think that they were the only ones who got a chance. They were first, but also the Greeks. So that when Paul says to the Jew first, and also the Greek, again, he's not trying to correct the notion that Jews and Greeks are equal and trying to say, no, let's keep the Jews in the proper place of superiority here. The Jews are first, Greeks next. What he was trying to correct is the Jewish notion that it was to the Jew only. And he says, no, it wasn't to the Jew only, just to the Jew first. They just had the first opportunity, but also the Greeks are in here in God's plan. And it's very important that we see that, and Paul himself interprets his meaning as that, as I pointed out in Romans 2, verses 9 through 11, where after twice saying it's to the Jew first and also the Greek, he then says, because there is no partiality. So the statement there, to the Jew first and also the Greek, means there is no partiality. It means that God is not showing partiality to the Jew. Their firstness is simply a matter of fact, a matter of history. It's just a matter of chronological reality. They were first. But the point he's emphasizing is, but it's also for the Greeks. It's not just for you Jews. And so, if I would give any kind of a label to these first few chapters, first three or four chapters, I would entitle it Jews and Gentiles Alike. And the people who have to be addressed most emphatically to get this across is the Jews. There's very little reason to believe that the Gentiles in the church thought themselves to be God's chosen people to the exclusion of the Jewish members of the church. But there is evidence, and chapter 2 makes it very clear that this was the case, that the Jewish people in the church thought that maybe the Gentiles would never be quite at their level because they weren't circumcised and because they were not under the law and they had never been, and they didn't do the things the Jews did. So Paul is addressing the Jewish notion of Jewish superiority here right from the beginning. Now, he says in verse 16 that the gospel is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes. And therefore, he has stated his basic premise. That is, salvation is by believing. It is not by believing plus circumcision. It's not by believing plus keeping the law. It's not by believing plus having the right pedigree. You've got Jewish ancestors or whatever. It's simply this. It's by believing. Period. And this is true whether a person is a Jew or whether they're a Greek. It's not any different for either one. It's to everyone who believes, the Jew first, also the Greek. And he continues, for in it, and of course the subject of the sentence, it, goes back to the word the gospel. In verse 17, for in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. As it is written, the just shall live by faith. Now, I might just say at the beginning, the expression from faith to faith is extremely difficult. A survey of the commentators or even the modern translations of this phrase will show how many opinions there are as to what exactly the expression from faith to faith means. Whether it means from God's faithfulness to our faith, or whether it means from one level of faith to another level of faith, or what is a matter of dispute. And I will say this, I am as without certainty about this as any commentator is. It simply is an ambiguous expression. Certainly Paul knew what he meant, but it's not clear to anyone else necessarily what he meant. At least we could not say he meant this, and with a degree of certainty that would exclude all other theories about what he meant by that. One thing that many commentators think he is saying, and this may well be it, is when he says from faith to faith, is what he means is it's from beginning to end a matter of faith. It starts with faith and ends with faith. In my opinion, that might be the best way to understand the phrase. It works for me. I'll live with it. If it means something else, he can let me know when I see him. But it won't change very much about my way of understanding Romans proper. But he says, in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. And let us just say, for the sake of having something to say, that from faith to faith means from beginning and end to end. It's a matter of faith. It starts with faith and ends with faith. It's from faith to faith. When you start it, it's started by faith. When you get to the end, it's still a matter of faith. And that righteousness of God is a matter of being saved by faith. Now, the righteousness of God, remember we, in our introduction, I said this expression is ambiguous, and it could mean God's own innate character trait of righteousness, his own personal justice, a description of what he's like. He's just, he's righteous. But it can also mean the righteousness that is from God, imputed to us. We are righteous, but not of ourselves, but of God. It is a righteousness that is of God, or from God, imputed to us from him. And certainly Paul has that in mind in the book of Romans as well. Which he has in mind, which of these two, in this phrase, is disputable? I am of the opinion that Paul means both. Now, it might be unusual for a man to use an ambiguous phrase that could mean two different things and mean both. I mean, usually he means one or the other. But it seems to me that both ways of understanding this phrase work here. That the righteousness of God's own character is revealed in the gospel. And he points this out later on in chapter 3. I believe we looked at it in our introduction. He pointed out that in the gospel, God has made a way to justify people who are guilty and to do so without compromising his own integrity or his own righteousness. A difficult thing to do. You've got somebody who's manifestly guilty. You're called to make a judgment about it. And you say, innocent. How do you do that? How do you do that without lying? How do you do that without compromising what you know is fair and just and according to truth? Well, God found a way to do that. And as it says in Romans 3:26, after Paul has laid out some of the information about how God has worked out this dilemma, it says in verse 26, to demonstrate at the present time his righteousness. Okay, we talk about the righteousness of God. That's his righteousness. In the gospel, God has demonstrated his righteousness. Now, he amplifies on that. That he might be just. That means righteous. And the justifier of him who believes in Jesus. So, of course, we'll have to, before we fully understand the importance of that verse, we have to study the verses before it, which we will eventually do. But what I'm saying is, his righteousness, God's righteousness, in Romans 3:26, is God's own justice. He demonstrates his righteousness so that he can justify sinners and still be just, still be righteous himself. So the righteousness of God, his own innate justice, is revealed in the gospel. But we also know that there is a righteousness of God that is imputed to us, and that is revealed in the gospel also, because in Romans 3, also, verse 21, he says, but now the righteousness of God, that's the same expression, apart from the law is revealed, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God, which is through faith in Jesus. Now, when he talks about the righteousness of God, which is through faith, he's not talking about God's innate justice. God isn't made just by my having faith in Jesus. I receive his righteousness by having faith in Jesus. The righteousness of God, which is through faith in Jesus and apart from the law, has to do with the righteousness that I receive, that I partake of in Jesus, that is of God. And so Paul uses the term the righteousness of God, as he, especially in chapter 3, verses 21 through 26, is kind of laying out the basic gospel apart from the law. And he uses the term the righteousness of God to mean the righteousness that I possess because of God, and also God's own innate justice and righteousness, his righteousness in verse 26. So although it seems unusual for a man to use an ambiguous phrase and to mean both meanings in one statement rather than picking one of them in order to talk about it, it seems clear that when he says in the gospel the righteousness of God is revealed, he actually means both. The righteousness of God's own uncompromising integrity, and the righteousness that I receive from God, which is, of course, the only way that I can be saved. And he will go on, of course, especially in chapter 3, to demonstrate how this righteousness of God is revealed. But he says, it is from faith to faith, as it is written, we're in Romans 1:17 again, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Now the statement, the just shall live by faith, is a quote from Habakkuk, chapter 2 and verse 4. Interestingly, Paul is quoting from the Greek Old Testament here, because the same verse in the Hebrew reads a little differently. In the Hebrew text, it actually says the just shall live by his faithfulness, which sounds like it is saying that a man will survive, and it's in a context in Habakkuk, where God is talking about the judgment that is coming on Jerusalem at the hands of the Babylonians, and that there will be devastation and judgment and death and great loss. But he says the just shall live, the way the Hebrew text stands, by his faithfulness, which would suggest that the just man would be singled out. There's a remnant there in Jerusalem. There's going to be widespread carnage and death, but there will be some who are spared. There will be some who live in spite of the fact that people all around them are dying. There will be a remnant who are declared to be just, and that person who is in that category, that just man, will live because of his faithfulness to God. Now that's an entirely different thought than what Paul is saying here. But long before Paul ever came on the scene, 70-something Jewish scholars in Alexandria, Egypt, translated the whole Old Testament into Greek, into what's called the Septuagint. And when they came to this passage in Habakkuk, they took that statement and translated it, the just shall live by faith rather than faithfulness. And Paul makes great use of that. He quotes it, I believe, at least in two of his epistles, and it's found also in Hebrews, which, if it is not written by Paul, is written by somebody greatly influenced by Paul. We can see that this statement in Habakkuk is very much a favorite of Paul's. There's two Old Testament passages that Paul liked best to prove the doctrine of justification by faith. One was this one, Habakkuk 2:4, and the other was Genesis 15:6, which says Abraham believed God and it was imputed to him for righteousness. And an excellent choice, because one's from the law and the other's from the prophets. And if he wants to prove that this gospel is taught in the law and the prophets to the Jews, there's no higher authority than the law and the prophets. He's got one quote from the law and one from the prophets to both of them make his point. The question is, though, does the one in Habakkuk make Paul's point? Is he missing the meaning? Is he working from a faulty translation? You know, I mean, if he went back to the Hebrew, it wouldn't make his point. But he uses the Greek translation, and that makes his point. Is that sort of like someone taking, you know, the Living Bible and a verse that's kind of questionably translated and taking the particular wording in it and making a doctrine from that wording when, in fact, the original Greek doesn't say what it says there? Some might think so, but, you know, there's another thing to consider, and that is this, that the Hebrew text, as we have it, is not necessarily the original, because it has come down to us, as we all know, through various copies, and there are various ways in which the text, at least in minor points, has been altered through copy. We don't have the original autographs from Habakkuk, for example. And it is possible, since the Septuagint, that is the Greek translation, is actually older than the oldest Hebrew texts that we have, it is clear that whoever translated the Septuagint used an earlier Hebrew text than that which we have. And if they translated the just shall live by faith, maybe that's what the Hebrew text said in their day. But in the later Hebrew copies, which have produced the text as we have it in Hebrew, it may have been altered. Maybe the Jews didn't like the feeling of that. Justified by faith? What about the law? What about being faithful to God? And maybe some little copy is stuck in there. Let's put faithfulness in there. That makes more sense. God would save people because of their faithfulness, not because of their faith. Now, I don't know how it happened. All I can say is this, that in the New Testament, almost completely, universally, when the New Testament writers quoted the Old Testament, although they all knew how to speak Hebrew, with the possible exception of Luke might not have known Hebrew because he was a Greek, but all the other writers of the New Testament were Jews. They knew Hebrew. They could read the Hebrew text. Yet they always quoted from the Septuagint. When I say always, there'd be a few exceptions. Sometimes they'd paraphrase and make their own translations, but certainly far and away above anything else, they would quote from the Septuagint. And this either means that although they knew the Septuagint was a faulty translation in some cases, they still thought it was close enough to truth to use it, and since it was popularly used, they just felt like going with it, like if I use the NIV, knowing very well it's not a great translation, but everybody's using it, so I might as well use it. I mean, that could be it. Or it could be that they knew also that the Septuagint was accurate. And the only reason it seems inaccurate to us is because we compare it with a Hebrew text that is of a later date than that, and it doesn't really reflect it. I mean, I don't know. I would think one would be entitled to hold the theory that the Septuagint is closer to the text that we have. What we can say is that in the Hebrew text, as we have it, it says in Habakkuk, the just man shall live by his faithfulness. But Paul makes great use of the Greek rendering, the just shall live by his faith. And rather than saying that Paul is pulling a fast one here, and using what he knows to be a faulty translation to make a point that would otherwise be weak and unestablished in Scripture, that he is actually aware that the Hebrew text, maybe in his day, did say the same thing as the Greek text. Now, of course, we do have the Dead Sea Scrolls, and they date from about his day. But it's possible that there are corruptions in here. So I'm not saying this is so. I'm saying that this is not an impossibility. I would say this. It would be strange for Paul, knowing Hebrew as well as he did, he probably read the Hebrew Bible more often than the Greek, being a member, you know, a Jewish scholar as he was. It'd be strange for him to try to pull a fast one and say, I know that the Hebrew text doesn't say this, but most of these people don't know that. They read the Greek, so I'll just quote from the Greek and that'll make my point. He'd be taking too great a risk, because the people most critical of his view about justification by faith would be the Jewish element. And if the Hebrew scriptures were familiar to any element in society, it would be to the Jewish element. And if he was trying to do something that required ignorance of the Jewish or Hebrew text in order to prove to the Jews something, it doesn't seem likely that he could hope to get away with it. And I think that his quotation of the Septuagint must reflect something very close, if not identical, to what his Jewish critics would find if they looked it up in the Hebrew text at their time. Else he could not have been foolish enough to use it as an argument against them. Do you understand what I'm saying? Or have I lost you all here? The point being, I'm going to take Paul at face value when he quotes it, the just shall live by faith, even though it looks different than our Hebrew text. Paul knew the Hebrew, and he knew the Greek, and I'm going to assume that he did not do anything that was out of harmony with what the Hebrew text said in his day. Now, he is therefore quoted Habakkuk, but that doesn't even solve all the problems. Because even if Habakkuk said it this way, the just shall live by faith, that still is not altogether a clear statement about justification by faith. It could say that because of a man's faith, he will not die. That is, in the Holocaust of 586 BC, when the Babylonians came in the days of Habakkuk, and that God spared a remnant, he could even have spared them by their faith. But it wouldn't necessarily prove justification by faith. It wouldn't necessarily prove that just because God spared them of that particular Holocaust, that they were justified before God and had eternal life. You know, that wouldn't follow. But what Paul, I think, is understanding from this, and I trust Paul to be the inspired interpreter. He was an apostle of Jesus Christ. Christ gave his apostles special understanding of what the Old Testament said. Remember, Jesus opened their understanding, that they might understand the Scriptures. There are things that we and they would not have understood in the Scriptures if Christ had not opened their understanding. And that fact that he did means that they understood the Scriptures in a way that we might not otherwise. So I'm always thankful when Paul quotes a Scripture and ends up giving it a different meaning than I would have. I'm thankful that he quoted it and told me that that was its meaning, because the meaning I would have gotten at it would be different. But he was the inspired apostle. And therefore, what he gave, the meaning was the one that Christ showed him that it meant. So I trust him. Now, if someone didn't trust Paul, then that, you know, that'd be a different story. Now, Paul understands this statement, the just shall live by faith, to mean this. The man who is just, remember the word means righteous, and who lives, because he is righteous, he lives. God does not judge him, does not kill him, does not condemn him, because in God's sight he is just or righteous. He does so because of his faith, that his justice or his righteousness is by faith. And some people have rephrased this. I don't know because I don't know the Greek syntax well enough. But some scholars have rephrased this. That the statement is, "He who by faith is just shall live." Now I'm going to trust the scholars on that. That's not always a safe thing to do. But since I'm not a Greek scholar, I'm going to trust that scholars who write commentaries, their books are up for peer review, and they can always be critiqued by other scholars if they get it too far wrong. And I have often read commentators say, well, this should be rendered, "He who by faith is just shall live." And that would certainly make Paul's point. The person will live who is justified by faith, would be really what it says. And I'm going to give Paul the credit for that being the meaning, because that's what he says it is. So he takes an Old Testament text, this time from the prophets, and proves the doctrine of justification by faith. Now, that is the gospel in a nutshell, really, in verses 16 and 17. But he realizes that he's introduced some things. Salvation, for example, in verse 16. It's the power of God to salvation to him who believes. He's introduced the idea of justification. He's introduced the idea of being justified by faith as opposed to some other means. And yet, there may be some who feel that, A, they don't need salvation for one reason or another, either because they're not that bad or maybe just even because they've got Jewish parents. I've got it, man. I'm in the group. I'm in the chosen few because I had Jewish parents and grandparents. That is an attitude that many people have and had. And that is that I was born in the church. I was baptized as a baby. You know, my family's always been Christians. You meet people like that who are not Jews who believe that. And the Jews felt that way about their ancestry and their upbringing. I'm one of God's people. And so he wants to make it clear to them that they are in trouble with God. People don't look for this kind of salvation and justification unless they realize they're in trouble with God. When I was down in Chile, I was talking to the leader of the YWAM base there, and he's a surfer, and he's always been a surfer. He's a surfing instructor and stuff too. And his YWAM base is a very nice place for surfers. Not surprisingly, I don't know if it's coincidentally, but he established it and chose the location. But he's a good man, a very good man, and a good leader. But he was telling me about a friend of his in Santa Cruz, California, because that's where he's from, who had been out surfing in the waves or swimming. No, there's a guy swimming out in the Monterey Bay, swimming across the bay. And like a Coast Guard ship or some kind of a Baywatch boat or something pulled up to him and said, a great white shark has been seen in this area. And maybe you better get in the boat with me here. And the guy says, "Nah, I've been out here for hours. I haven't seen anything. I'll just keep going." And the guy in the boat kept prevailing. "I think you better get in the boat. You know, we've spotted it. It's here. It's been in the area for a few days. And it may come after you." And the guy says, "No, I really think I'm okay. We'll do fine." And then just as they were having that conversation, he said, they saw the dorsal fin about 50 yards away coming their direction. And the swimmer looked and he saw it, and the guy said, "Quick, get in the boat." And he pulled him out of the water. And he said the shark went by the boat so near that, in fact, he was able to reach out and touch the fin. He said, this is my only chance in my life to touch the dorsal fin of a live white shark. And he reached out and he touched the fin as it went by the boat. But here, this guy was out there swimming. He didn't fear there was any danger. You know, why should I get out of the boat? I'm swimming for exercise and enjoyment. I want to do what I'm doing. Getting in the boat is not what I want to do. I'm okay. There's no problems here. I've been out in this water 100 times before. This bay, it's a safe place. But when he saw the dorsal fin coming, his whole attitude toward his need to be pulled out of the water changed, because he realized he was in trouble. And Paul realizes that there's readers of his epistle who don't know that they're in trouble. And so he wants to let them know they are in trouble. And so he begins in this vein in verse 18. He says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven Okay, that's the dorsal fin, man. I mean, the wrath of God is scarier than any great white shark. And the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. Now, God's wrath is a concept that a lot of people have trouble with. They just don't, wrath and anger, these are emotions for the weak. I mean, it even says in the book of Proverbs, greater is he that can rule his spirit than he that takes a city. And a man of wrath, soon comes to harm or something. I mean, a man who rules his spirit is in contrast with a man who gets angry easily. And anger is even, we're commanded not to be angry in Scripture. Put away all wrath and all anger and all malice and so forth. So we have reason to believe that anger and wrath are not good attitudes to have, and that Christians are told not to have them, and that wrath and anger is a sin, and that really Christians should be able to rise above petty irritations and injuries and forgive and not get angry and kind of, you know, avoid being offended and so forth. I mean, those things are taught in Scripture. And yet we read of God getting angry and God having wrath. And it kind of seems strange. I mean, people think, well, God ought to be spiritual enough that he can, you know, he can handle, you know, irritations without getting angry. It's beneath the dignity of God to believe that God gets angry. And so some have argued that the wrath of God is not a description of him at all. That either Paul and those who spoke about the wrath of God were simply perpetuating an old Jewish, you know, prejudice or myth or attitude that we who live now later in the Christian age have outgrown the need for that belief. We now realize that God is motivated by love and we should obey him motivated by love. We don't have to be threatened with, you know, threats of hell and punishment and stuff. God's not that kind of a God. He's a God of love. And this talk about the wrath of God, that's all just a throwback to the Jewish unenlightened view of God probably coming out of the rabbinic teachings that God's going to thump you if you don't keep the law or whatever, you know. And so there are some who reject the doctrine of the wrath of God altogether. And others say, well, God doesn't actually get angry. This is just an anthropomorphic way of speaking, that God acts in judgment without getting angry. But he acts the way that we would expect a person to act if he was angry. A little bit like when it says of Noah in the ark, he was there about a year, and it says, and then God remembered Noah. And he sent a wind to dry up the earth, as if God had forgotten. Well, we know God didn't really forget Noah. But it talks as if he did. Why? That's an anthropomorphic. Anthropomorphic means it speaks of God as if he were man. It's just a way of helping make the way God is somewhat more understandable to us, or we can relate a little more with it. And some think that when the Bible talks about the wrath of God, this is simply an anthropomorphic device. God doesn't really get angry. He doesn't really lose his cool. He just acts at times in disinterested judgment, in just bare justice, in a way that we would interpret. If a man acted the same way, we'd see that as an act of wrath, of anger. But God doesn't really get angry. Well, I actually disagree with both of those approaches to the wrath of God. The Bible has no problem with the wrath of God in the sense of it being a philosophical anomaly or something. We've got the wrath of God manifest in the Old Testament, and we've got it equally in the New Testament. It certainly is not an idea confined to Old Testament teaching. One can satisfy himself that the New Testament fully treats the aspect of God's nature, which involves his wrath, without embarrassment, by simply reading the book of Revelation, where you read repeatedly of the bowls of his wrath and the wrath of him that sits on the throne and of the Lamb. Now, that's a weird expression, the wrath of the Lamb. A lamb? I mean, we know that the lamb's an expression for Jesus, but there are other ways Jesus is spoken of besides the lamb, and to use that, to mix those ideas, here's a lamb. Who ever heard of a lamb getting mad? But the scriptural writers don't have any problem mixing those ideas. There is nothing unloving. There is nothing even unkind about God getting angry towards certain things. It says in the book of Psalms that God is angry at the wicked every day. And we see even Jesus Christ getting angry. Now, I'm not referring to the time he cleansed the temple. Some people might say, well, Jesus acted kind of angry there, but it doesn't ever say that he was angry then. We shouldn't accuse Jesus of being angry, because anger is an emotion below his dignity and below his goodness and spirituality level and so forth. But really, we are told directly in another occasion, not related to the cleansing of the temple, that Jesus was angry. It's in the Gospel of Mark, in chapter 3, when he was in a synagogue and there was a man with a withered hand, and he asked the critics there whether they thought it was appropriate for him to heal on the Sabbath or not. They refused to answer. And he realized they were simply climbing up because if they answered one way or another, it would not help their cause, and they were not being honest. And it says in verse 5, Mark 3, 5, so when he, Jesus, had looked around at them with anger, being grieved by the hardness of their hearts, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. Jesus looked on them with anger. But Jesus never sinned. Is there an anger that is not sin? Is there an anger that somebody who is sinless and pure and almost infinitely patient could have? Well, one of the same contexts where we're told to put away all wrath and all anger, if you look at Ephesians chapter 4, Ephesians 4:31, Paul says, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice. So wrath and anger are to be eliminated. Yet he says, in the same chapter, a few verses earlier, verse 26, Ephesians 4:26, be angry and do not sin. Now, he's actually quoting from the Old Testament. He's quoting Psalm 4:4, which says, be angry and do not sin. But he says, do not let the sun go down on your wrath. Now, it's interesting. We are supposed to put away anger and put away wrath. But there is an anger that is not sin. And there is a wrath which exists even in the heart of the Christian, but is not supposed to be allowed to endure until sundown. It's not. You have to put it away. You can't hold on to it. But there is a difference, apparently, between sin and anger. But much anger is sin. But apparently not all anger is. Because if all anger was itself sin, then Jesus couldn't be angry and be sinless as he was. And it could not even be said without making nonsense, be angry but don't sin. Quite obviously, this suggests there is such a thing as an anger that is not sin. Now, we could speculate as to what the fine points of difference are between anger that is sin and anger that is not. I would tell you this. I think that when Jesus in Matthew chapter 5 said, he that is angry at his brother without cause shall be in danger of the judgment, that we have some idea of what he's talking about here. But it's the problem with that is that in some manuscripts, the Alexandrian text, it doesn't say without cause. It just says he that is angry with his brother. The Alexandrian text, which the modern translations follow, says he that is angry at his brother is in danger of the judgment. But in the Textus Receptus, followed by King James and New King James, it says he that is angry at his brother without cause shall be guilty of the judgment. So we don't even know whether that phrase was originally in there or not, because the texts don't agree. We're talking about Matthew 5:22. But we can say this, that when Jesus said, whoever is angry at his brother, even if he didn't say without cause, he must have implied, with or without stating it, that we're talking here about a sinful kind of anger, obviously. A murderous kind of anger, even. But Jesus could not be saying that anger is always sin, or else he himself sinned by being angry. Let me suggest to you a couple of ways to look at this. One way is that anger in man is more often than not, far more often than not, selfish and self-concerned. The people you are likely to be angry at most is the people who have injured you or insulted you or slighted you or done something to you. You have sustained injury, and because of it, you are angry. You are resentful. You're bitter or whatever. That is carnal. That is fleshly. That is self-centered. It is loving yourself more than loving someone else. Now, Jesus indicated you're supposed to even love your enemies. And yet, if you are angry at somebody who has hurt you, it means that you don't love them because you love you. And that is sin, to love yourself more than you love them. Even if they're bad people and you're a good person, you're still to love them at least as much as you love yourself, not if not more. To put them above you, to esteem others better than yourself, the Bible says. Now, there is an anger rarely found among unconverted people, but not too uncommon, I think, among godly people. There is an anger that is not self-interested. It is a disinterested anger in the sense that it does not arise out of personal injury or personal concern. We never see Jesus getting angry at people who hurt him. At least he didn't get angry at them for hurting him. When they nailed him to the cross, he was completely innocent. It was an absolute act of injustice and a painful one. And yet his attitude was, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And Jesus was very generous toward people who hurt him and hurt him bad. He did not get angry at them. Who did he get angry at? He got angry at people who defiled his Father's house. He got angry at those who misrepresented God to the popular masses so that the popular masses thought God was something other than he was and rejected the notion of God as they knew him because the religious leaders had so misrepresented God as to make God a reproach in the eyes of the people and to alienate people who needed God from him because they had false notions of him. This is what the Pharisees did, and this is the context in which we always find Jesus getting angry. And I'm not afraid to say he was angry when he cleansed the temple, although the Bible doesn't use the word anger in that particular place. He looked pretty angry to me. He spoke in words that are hard to interpret without the idea of anger. When he, in Matthew 23, when he went on his tirade against the scribes and Pharisees, said, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites, you snakes, you vipers! How can you escape the damnation of hell because you do this and you do that and you do that?" Not one time did he say, "Because you hurt my feelings. Because you said bad things about me." It's always because they pretend to be God's agents, but they misrepresent God at every turn. So that the common people, who would otherwise perhaps be attracted to God, are turned away from God by them. It is the injury done to others by these people that inspired Jesus' anger. And I don't think there's an unrighteousness about having an anger arise when you hear of horrible abuses of people that you know are an offense to God. You know God's angry at it. When you hear people abusing or molesting children, when you hear of genocide being perpetrated against, Sudanese villages or whatever. I mean, when you hear about horrendous, horrible abuses of people, of innocent people being done, if that doesn't make you angry, if that doesn't upset you, then how can you even be, how can everybody suggest that you have any love in your heart? There is a certain anger that love inspires. If somebody starts beating up an innocent child in my presence, I'm going to get angry. Now, if that person beats me up, I hope I won't get angry. But if they beat up somebody else, and it's an unprovoked attack, and there's no justice in it, it's just, wickedness, I'm going to get angry. I don't mind telling you that. I think God gets angry at that, too. The Bible indicates it. Jesus got angry. We are even supposed to get angry. Be angry, but don't sin. Now, when the Bible says, put away anger and put away wrath, I believe that's connected with his second statement, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. In other words, even though there are things that might legitimately make you angry, don't just Don't just internalize it and live with anger and bitterness and resentment. Put it away. Now, the best way to put away wrath is to resolve the matter one way or another, if you can. If it's a matter that you can resolve by your own personal intervention, fine. Do it and be done with your anger. And I don't mean, you know, go blow some away and then say, oh, I feel much better now. I'm not angry anymore, you know. What I mean is if there's some legitimate thing that you can do and should do in a situation where you are vexed, righteously vexed, and you should do something about it, then do it. And then, you know, let the anger be gone. I'm not saying ventilate it. I'm not saying go out and do something violent and, you know, and you feel a lot better. I'm saying that there are righteous responses to cases where you are righteously vexed. Do the righteous thing, and then you don't have to continue being vexed. But if you just kind of do nothing and just internalize it and live with it and sleep on it and it festers in you, this is not, you know, this is going to defile your spirit. Put it away. Don't even let the sun go down on it. Now, you know, if somebody has injured you, I don't think you're supposed to be angry, but I do think you're supposed to address it. I think you're supposed to tell them. Jesus said, if your brother sins against you, rebuke them. Confront them, you know, and if they repent, forgive them. And Jesus taught thoroughly that we need to maintain a forgiving attitude, as God has one. It's interesting, the same Bible that talks about the wrath of God and talks unembarrassedly about the wrath of God, talks about God as the model of forgiveness and the one that we should forgive like He forgives. What we need to recognize is that God is a real person. He's a complex being like real people are. To make Him some kind of monolithic essence of love, just kind of the spirit of love out there, you know, and there's no other aspects to His personality, is to make Him less complex than we are. God is a personal being. He's not an essence. He's not a force. He's a person who has the full range of emotions. He just doesn't sin. His emotions are always justified. His are always pure, and He always does the right thing about them. We don't. Sometimes our emotions are not justified, or if they are justified, they're totally selfish. And often we don't do the right thing about them, and we sin. So this idea of God having wrath is not something we have to feel embarrassed about or somehow explain away. There's nothing wrong with God's wrath. God is not angry because of what people have done to Him primarily. I'm not saying He's pleased with what people have done to Him, but His anger is based on the fact, at least judging from the cases that we read of Jesus' anger, and He's the model of who the Father is like, His anger is toward those who are victimizing innocent people by their sinful lifestyles. And of course, even if he had something of just a personal offendedness about people thumbing their nose at Him, who could say that He isn't justified in being angry at that? Because that always has social ramifications. A person may not love me, and they still might not do much harm to society, but if they don't love God, they're going to do harm everywhere they turn because they're going to be living a totally selfish life. And Jesus said, He that is not for me is against me. They're not going to be living a neutral life. They're going to have an impact. So I don't mind talking about the wrath of God and the anger of God. Some people want to shy away from it because they're afraid that people are going to complain about all that hellfire and damnation teaching. Remember Keith Green saying that whenever someone says, I can't stand to listen to that hellfire and damnation teaching, he says, when's the last time you ever heard any? If you don't like it, you're in good luck, you know, because you're not going to ever hear it in the churches. But you'll hear it when you read what Jesus preached. And certainly you'll find it in the Bible. God is an angry God, but He's a loving and forgiving God. That's not a contradiction any more than to say that I can be angry at injustice and angry at abuse and still be a generally generous and forgiving and loving person. That's possible. And to make God less complex than human beings is kind of a folly, it seems to me. We don't have to try to be reductionistic and say God is this one thing only and everything else that we have a hard time fitting into that picture, it just doesn't work. We have to throw it out, even if the Bible teaches it. It does. Now, Paul says that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. You see, this is in juxtaposition with him saying in verse 17 that the righteousness of God is revealed. There's two things about God that are revealed. You've got the revelation of the righteousness of God, and that revelation is in the gospel. And now you also have the revelation of the wrath of God. In fact, it is because of the revelation of the wrath of God, already revealed from heaven, that we need to get the revelation of His righteousness so that we can escape that wrath. We need the gospel because the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. This revelation of God's wrath is actually prior to the revelation of His righteousness in the gospel. The revelation of God's wrath is the reason for considering and looking at this revelation of the righteousness of God in the gospel. That's why he says, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. And notice the objects of God's wrath. In my upbringing, I was encouraged to believe, and I suppose I did believe much of the time, that God was angry at everyone who hadn't heard the gospel. Now, he may be angry at a lot of people who haven't heard the gospel. But my impression was that everyone who has accepted Jesus, who has heard the gospel and received it and become saved, they're the only ones God's not angry at. And yet when I read the Bible tells me who God is angry at. And it seems like a smaller group than what I once thought. I once thought that, you know, God's just angry at everybody. And the only way to get his anger off you is to get saved. Well, maybe that's true. I don't want to say for sure that it isn't. But the scripture doesn't say that, as far as I can tell. Maybe it does. Maybe I'm not thinking of something. But when I think of the passages that talk about God's anger, they all speak with sort of a united voice. God is angry at people who suppress the truth because of their unrighteousness. Is God angry at little babies? Some people think so. Some people think that God's angry at little babies because of what Adam did. And because Adam did that, God's mad at babies. When they die, he sends them right to hell. Because he's so mad at them. Well, I don't find it in the Bible. I mean, maybe it's there somewhere, but someone's going to have to comb it a little with a finer comb than I have to find those verses that say that. What I find here is that God is angry. His anger is particularly directed toward those who suppress what they know to be true, because they prefer a life of unrighteousness. In their unrighteousness, they suppress the truth. In order to suppress the truth, you have to have some inkling of what it is. You could be ignorant of the truth, and that's different than suppressing the truth. Now, that it is those who suppress the truth, or who reject the truth, or who do everything they can to ignore the truth that they have been exposed to, that these are the special objects of God's wrath, seems to be taught elsewhere in Scripture too, both by Paul and by Jesus. In 1 Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, Paul is talking about the coming of the lawless one, the man of sin, the son of perdition. And he says in verse 10, this man will come with all unrighteousness or unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. Now, these are the people that God is sending a delusion to so they'll be condemned. He's obviously angry at these people. He wants them condemned. He guarantees it by sending them a delusion that they will believe the lie. Now you might say, I thought God wants all people to be saved. He does. But there are certain people who have already reacted to his offer in such a way as to be already under his judgment. It's not that he wanted them to go to hell. They've already made their choices. He sent them the truth, and they did not receive the love of the truth. They didn't like the truth. They didn't want the truth. They believed a lie because that's what they wanted. Instead, they did not believe the truth, but they had pleasure in unrighteousness. These are those who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness that Paul refers to in Romans 1:18. Now, these are the ones that God will is going to show his wrath toward and does show his wrath toward. This agrees with what Jesus taught, I believe. In John chapter 3, verse 17 and following, Jesus said, "For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. He who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already." Why? Because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And this is the condemnation. Now we're talking about people who are unbelievers, and they're condemned. Why? What is the condemnation? What is the basis of this judgment upon them? Well, this is the condemnation: that light has come into the world, and men loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. The men loved darkness. They saw the light, but they didn't want the light. They suppressed the light. They suppressed the truth. Now, is it true of all people that they've seen the light and rejected it, even the ones who have never heard of Jesus? I don't know. I don't know them all. But the Bible does not teach me that everyone has rejected the light, but the ones who have done so are condemned. And they need the gospel. They need to turn to Christ. All people need to turn to Christ. But what about people who never heard of Christ? I don't know the answer. But it is possible, especially babies and little children who haven't heard and don't know, that God is not angry at them. It's not as if light has come to them and they love darkness rather than light. They haven't gotten much light. Maybe they don't have any light in the certain early days. What will God do in their case? I don't know, but I don't think the Bible teaches that he responds in anger toward them. Will he condemn them? I don't know. Jesus said the condemnation is that they loved the darkness after they had light. Well, what about before they had light? What if light hasn't come into their world? Certainly Jesus is saying that the light has come into the world of the people that he is talking to, and they reject him and they don't believe in him and they're condemned because the light has come to them and they love the darkness instead. But has the light come to all people? In measure, yes. I don't want you to think that I'm suggesting, because I'm not, that if a person hasn't heard the gospel, they therefore are innocent and going to heaven. That is not what I believe. I believe that anyone who rejects the light that God gives them is suppressing the truth in their unrighteousness, and God's wrath is toward them. And that may be even if they haven't heard the gospel. The fact that a person hasn't heard the gospel doesn't mean they have no light. In fact, Paul goes on in Romans chapter 1 to describe the light of nature. God has revealed himself in the things that he's made. Even people who have never heard the gospel have seen the sky and seen plants and animals and seen nature. And Paul is indicating they are without excuse. If they're atheists, because even if they've never heard the gospel, they're without excuse, because he has manifested that he exists. His eternal Godhead and power is manifest in the things he's made. So they're without excuse. There is light that people can receive. I don't know whether we can say that's enough light to save them. That's another issue. But it's enough light to condemn them if they reject it. There's also the light of the conscience. All people at a certain point in their life become internally aware that there is an issue of right and wrong in the world, that life has its moral issues. They may not be so sensitive about this when it's their own behavior, but if when someone does it to them, they know it's wrong. You know, I mean, when people say, there's no absolute right or wrong, I say, okay, you don't mind, it wouldn't be wrong for me to break into your house, kill you, and steal your stereo, right? Well, that would be wrong. Well, why would it be wrong? There's no absolute right or wrong. Well, it's wrong when you do it to me. That's not what they'd say, but that's what they imply. It's wrong if you do it to me. It's probably in becoming victimized by other people's sins that we become most sensitive to the fact that there is such a thing as wrongdoing. We may not be smart enough to apply it to ourselves and say it's wrong when I do it too. But anyone who's a thinker would take that step in their reasoning. If it's wrong for him to do it to me, it must be wrong when I do it to him. You know? And you don't need to be a person who's heard the gospel. You can be a savage in a tribe that's never been penetrated by civilized man at all, and you can know in your conscience that some things are right and some things are wrong. And furthermore, you can become condemned for violating your own conscience, because that is light that God sends. It says in John 1:9 that Jesus is the true light that enlightens every man that comes into the world. John 1:9. Jesus is the true light that enlightens everyone who comes into the world. Now, it doesn't mean everyone hears the name of Jesus, but it means that everyone receives some light from Jesus. The question next is, what do they do when light comes to them? Do they love darkness rather than light? Or do they say, I want more of this light? God knows. God knows the hearts of all people. I believe that many people who have not heard the gospel reject the light they have just as much as people who hear the gospel reject it and are just as much under God's condemnation. But I don't know that we could say that's universal. God might be calling people who have not heard the gospel through the light he's given them, and they may, I don't know, maybe, I mean, no one is saved apart from Jesus. But could they be saved by Jesus even if they never heard of him? I'm afraid God can only answer that question. I can't. But what I want to point out is that God is not just indiscriminately angry at everyone because they didn't hear the gospel. He's angry at people for a reason. They receive light and they love darkness. They suppress the light they have because it condemns them. It makes demands upon them. Light has its demands that it makes. And people who don't want to meet those demands would just soon pretend like the light wasn't there. Check out what Jesus said in John chapter 9 about the Pharisees of his day. In John chapter 9, verse 39 and following, Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may be made blind." And some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these words and said to him, "Are we blind also?" And Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now you say, 'We see.' Therefore your sin remains." He says, if you were blind, meaning if you didn't have any moral perception at all, you would have no sin. Now, there are no people on the earth, adults, who have no moral perception, unless these are extremely mentally handicapped people and little children, who could possibly be described as being truly blind. I mean, if a person was born and their brain was not functioning properly and they died, I don't believe that. I think they would have no sin. You know, if they were blind, they have no sin. Trouble is, they weren't blind and they were rejecting what they saw, and therefore their sin remains. Jesus made similar statements about those of his generation. Also in chapter 15 of John, verses 22 and 24. John 15:22, Jesus said, "If I had not come and spoken to them, they would have no sin. But now they have no excuse for their sin." Remember, Paul says in Romans 1, they are without excuse. Jesus says, well, these people are without excuse. Why? Because I have come and I have spoken to them. They've heard, they've seen, and they have rejected. Therefore, they have no excuse. But if I had not come, if they had not heard or seen, then their sin would not be counted against them. They would be, as it were, sinless before God. Also, verse 24, John 15:24, "If I had not done among them the works which no one else did, they would have no sin. But now they have seen and also hated both me and my Father." Here's what the sin is, that they have seen, and they have not seen in love. They have seen and hated because their deeds were evil. They hated the light. They loved the darkness. They suppressed the truth in their unrighteousness. It is this act of hating the truth that God is angry at. Because, I mean, certainly the implication of all of this is that the one thing that God expects of all people, regardless of whether they've heard the gospel or not, is that they embrace truth, is that they love truth, and that they love light. They may not have full light. In fact, you and I, we're very privileged to have the whole Bible, but there are things we don't understand. There are things in the Bible we don't know. We'll yet learn some more as we go along. For the rest of our lives, we'll probably learn more. And that means if we got more to learn, there's some things we don't know. There's a degree of ignorance even in us. We know in part. But that ignorance isn't enough to damn us, fortunately. We know enough, and the response we have made to what we know is enough we trust, to save us, even though our knowledge of all truth is not complete. So the question is, how much ignorance is possible to exist in a saved person? I don't know the answer. I'm not even looking to know the answer. All I'm saying is that God knows. But the attitude toward truth seems to be the thing that matters. The Bible seems to indicate that there are two classes of people. Those who love the truth more than anything else and will embrace the truth no matter what it costs, no matter how embarrassing or humiliating, they'll embrace it. And then there's the other category, those who love something else more than they love the truth. And for the sake of that something else, they will suppress the truth if necessary, for the sake of saving face, for the sake of feeling good about themselves, for the sake of being popular, for the sake of whatever. Business goals or financial goals or career goals. They'll suppress the truth because something matters more to them than truth. Those are the people of whom it says God will send them strong delusion that they may believe the lie because they did not receive the love of the truth. If I meet a person who loves truth but isn't yet a Christian, I tend to not call them a non-Christian but a pre-Christian. Because if a person really loves the truth more than anything, I do believe that God will bring them to Christ, who is the truth. But if someone doesn't care for the truth, even if they know the truth, even if they've nominally believed in Christianity, but if they reject truth and their attitude is they don't want any more truth, I'm concerned about their soul. Let's stop there and we'll come back to Romans 1 next time and continue with the following verses.